went miracle problem. Some people are confused by that problem and problem set. So, yeah, if there are any other things that seem confusing on the problem set, they weren't supposed to be. So, so let me know what you're confused about afterwards, and then I'll try to update the notes today to make the problem more clear. Okay. So today, once I've spent like more than let's say 10 minutes on baryogenesis, if someone could make a buzzer noise so that I don't just keep talking about baryogenesis. Baryogenesis is fascinating, but really, in this era of budget cuts, something has to go, and baryogenesis is gonna get short shrift in favor of inflation. I was explaining. So Sakharov's picture of baryogenesis is that the universe started out with zero asymmetry between baryons and antibaryons. And then physics produced it. So you didn't put in the asymmetry as an initial condition. The laws of nature are going to produce the asymmetry. So in other words, if f sub b, remember we had these distribution functions in phase space, f, a given species I, had its density in phase space was some distribution function, fi of xp and t. And Sakharov's suggestion is that what you should do is at sufficiently early times take the distribution function for I to be equal to the distribution function for the antiparticle species f I bar. So those two things are initially equal at some early time ti, and then at a later time, they're not equal. And so maybe this is just a more, I just wanted to say in case it was confusing, why when I say that C and CP are violated, so we have these discrete symmetries C, P, and T. T takes time to minus time. But the universe is expanding. It violates T symmetry. An expanding universe is different than a contracting universe, so we shouldn't expect. So the initial state was not T symmetric. So what I'm going to argue is I want to argue that C and CP have to be violated. And the basic argument is going to be that this initial condition is invariant under C and invariant under CP, whereas the final condition is not. But so this initial condition isn't invariant under T, so I shouldn't expect any constraint to be able to say anything about the T symmetry of the theory from this evolution. But for C and CP, the basic point is just, so let's first look at C. C says that you swap. C says that after you apply a C transformation, fi, the distribution function, is just equal to what I had previously called fi bar, and vice versa. Fi bar gets transformed to fi. But if fi is equal to fi bar at the initial time, then this transformation doesn't change anything. This just changes fi into itself and fi bar into itself. So that's what I mean when I say the initial state is fi symmetric. But if fi is not equal to fi bar, then a C transformation is doing something to the system. Changing fi to fi bar, changing the distribution function of baryons into the distribution function of antibaryons, has changed the distribution functions of the system. So it's not a symmetry. So if a state evolves from a CP symmetric state to a CP non-symmetric state, the evolution laws must violate C symmetry. And then you can make the same argument about CP. So what CP means is that if I take I in addition to a parity transformation, so I change F of X vector, P vector, and T vector to F I bar of minus X vector, minus P vector, and T. But that's still a symmetry because in an FRW spacetime, the distribution function has to be isotropic. So really, although we've written this thing as depending on X vector, in an FRW spacetime, to be consistent with the isotropy of the system, we actually have to write down distribution functions that only depend on the magnitude of X and the magnitude of P. And so that also isn't changed by this transformation. So again, so if our initial condition is that the Fs only depend on the magnitudes of X and P, and that these two things are equal, then this transformation just takes each F into itself. It doesn't change F. So again, the system is symmetric. And it doesn't depend on X. That's a good point. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, unless you take weird chord, yeah. But in spirit, what you say is absolutely right. Also, okay. So again, by the same argument, you can convince yourself that as long as this condition holds, then a CP transformation just takes each distribution function into itself. It does nothing to the system. So the initial state is CP symmetric. The final state, again, is not. So C and CP are violated. P, for the same reason, the initial state is P symmetric, and the final state is P symmetric, because a P transformation takes F of X, P, and T for the ith species into the ith species, not into the I bar species of minus X, minus P, minus T. But again, if this distribution function doesn't depend on X and only depends on the magnitude of P, a parity transformation takes the distribution function into itself, whether or not the I and I bar distribution functions are equal. So that's why you can't infer just from Sakharov type arguments that P is violated, but you can infer that C and CP are violated. Even though, in fact, now we know that the standard model violates all three of those things. But the point is just to clarify what his logic was. Is that clear? So baryon number has to be violated. Again, that I think is the easiest one to understand. If the number of baryons was equal to the number of antibaryons initially, and then at a later time the number of baryons was not equal to the number of antibaryons, then the total quote-unquote baryon number, which is number of baryons minus antibaryons, has gone from zero to non-zero. So that's just what we mean by baryon number being violated. And finally, thermal equilibrium. You have to go out of thermal equilibrium because let's say you find some process that where a state with baryon number B1 goes into a new state with baryon number B2, and which is different than B1, so baryon number is being violated. And also this thing satisfies the theory that produces this is C and CP violating, so you think you have all the necessary ingredients. But if you're in thermal equilibrium, this reaction won't create baryon number going in this direction, because in thermal equilibrium, the reaction is also proceeding in exactly the same rate in the opposite direction. So however much baryon number is created when this reaction goes in one direction, it's just erased when the reaction goes in the other direction. Okay, so but the point is now to look in a physical theory for if you want to have a candidate for baryogenesis, you know, as a first step, you can just look and see, does a particular physical process have these three properties, that it violates baryon number, violates CP, and violates and occurs out of thermal equilibrium. And so the first, I think Steven Weinberg, I'm not 100% sure about that, I think pointed out the first classic method of achieving baryogenesis, which is that just like in the standard model, you group, for example, two leptons that look quite different at low energies after spontaneous symmetry breaking, the neutrino, the left-handed neutrino and the left-handed part of the electron, you group those into a doublet, and when the Higgs, if you perch the Higgs, when symmetry is broken and the Higgs field is sitting over here, these look very different. This particle looks like it has charge and non-zero mass. This particle looks like it has no charge and zero or very little mass. But the idea is that if you perch the field up here, these particles look essentially just like two. They're essentially two identical particles. Their mass, the distinction between them is only coming because you've taken another field in the theory and displaced it from the symmetric point about which to view the theory. So similarly, the idea of grand unification is you take quarks and leptons, which look like very different particles in the ordinary standard model, and you group them together into multiplets akin to this. And so, for example, without getting into details, and then just as a W boson or a Z boson can couple to, just as after spontaneous symmetry breaking in the standard model, in Michael Peskin's course, you probably learned that some of the gauge bosons, like the photon, remain massless, but then others of the gauge bosons become massive, and those gauge bosons are the ones that let you transition between, that give rise to diagrams that transition between this sort of particle that would look like two of the same particle if you looked at the theory symmetrically, but look like very different particles at low energy. So you have a diagram like W nu left E minus left. So if time runs in this direction in this diagram, this says that a W boson can decay into these two rather look into this two rather look different looking pair. It can decay into a antineutrino and an electron. So similarly, when you group the quarks and leptons together, there are, after symmetry breaking, it is the very massive the gauge bosons that become very massive after symmetry breaking, analogous to the W boson. The grand unified gauge bosons that can do this business of decaying into in various ways into pairs of quarks and leptons. So in particular, there is a gauge boson in grand unified theories that can decay via two routes. It can either decay to a Q pair, to a pair of two quarks, or it can decay to a quark, anti-quark, and an anti-lepton. And so this process violates baryon number because this final state has baryon number, each quark has baryon number 1/3, so this final state has baryon number plus 2/3. Whereas this final state has baryon number minus 1/3 plus 0, so it has baryon number minus 1/3. So that's a baryon violating process because, in other words, there's a vertex where the X boson decays to two quarks. Or there's another vertex where the X boson decays to a quark bar and a lepton bar. But if you just pin these two, if you just join these two X particles together, you get some process where I've removed the bars because I've changed the order of time. So time is running this way. So outgoing antiparticles are like ingoing particles. If that doesn't make sense, it's not a terribly big deal. So the point is, baryon number is violated. A state with baryon number plus 1/3 can come in, and a state with plus 2/3 can come out, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so could I have another beep? And could I have another bell go off in 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Sorry. it's just too soon. Okay, so let me cut to the chase. So this X particle, suppose you have an X particle that can decay via one channel. That it has two different ways that it can decay, like analogous to these two different ways that it can decay. So it can either decay to a final state with baryon number B1, or it can decay to a final state with baryon number B2. Then its antiparticle will also have those two decay channels where the anti-X will decay to whatever these particles were, but they're antiparticles. So X decays to some particles with total baryon number B1. That means X bar decays to the antiparticles, which have total baryon number minus B1. And similarly, it has this second decay channel with baryon number minus B2. So now suppose you have a little box in the early universe that is filled with the X particles freeze out at some point, and then you have a little box that's full of X particles. And let's say that the branching ratio for this process, so a fraction r of the decays go this way, a fraction 1 minus r go this way, and here a fraction r bar of the decays go this way, and a fraction 1 minus r bar go this way. So it turns out that the condition, you might think that if this is just a particle and this is its antiparticle, that r and r bar have to be equal. But that's precisely what violating C and CP allows you to relax. That if you violate C and CP, I don't have time to explain this, but r need not be equal to r bar. And so I have some number density of chi particles, and then they all decay, and I want to calculate what is the resulting, let's imagine they all decay instantaneously. What is the resulting number density of baryon number produced in the final decay state? Well, it's a fraction, it's n sub chi times, well, a fraction r gets turned into baryon number b1, a fraction 1 minus r gets turned into baryon number b2. It's going to be horrible if there's another beep that I have to. A fraction r bar goes into baryon number minus b1, and a fraction 1 minus r bar goes into baryon number minus b2, which if you clean it up, just says that n chi, it just says it's the difference r minus r bar times the difference b1 minus b2. Okay, so my point is just to say here explicitly you see that to get non-zero baryon number out at the end, you needed violation of CP and C and CP. That's what you need to get the decay rate in quantum field theory of a particle and its antiparticle to have different branching ratios, a process and a given and an antiprocess to have different have different branching ratios, and you need baryon violation just to have two different decay channels that have different baryon number, because as we saw, that those two processes can be glued together to give a baryon number violating process. So there you see Sakharov condition 1 appears explicitly, Sakharov condition 2, baryon number violation, and then Sakharov condition 3 is just that to actually get this process to work, what we had to do is we had to let the let these X particles freeze out, and then let the temperature drop below their number density. So they had to go out of thermal equilibrium. The reason is the temperature dropped below their mass, I should say. So we had to wait for them to become more massive than the temperature of the bath, because otherwise, when they decay, there will be precisely enough particles in the thermal bath. The inverse process will be occurring at exactly the same rate. So this process will create net baryon number here, but the inverse process, where particles in the thermal bath just run into each other and create X and X bars out of nowhere, those will be creating, in thermal equilibrium, those will be creating, destroying exactly as much baryon number as you were creating by this process. Okay, so then, you know, if you wanted to, finally, you had a theory of particle physics and you wanted to just estimate, you want to know if it produces the observed value, eta, the baryon to photon ratio today, which is roughly 1 in a billion. Again, you use the fact that these quantities, you can calculate the freeze out abundance of this, like we did in the dark matter case. With some quantum field theory, you can identify the baryon violating processes and calculate the difference between the branching ratios r and r bar. So you go through, you identify the appropriate process, calculate the branching ratios using quantum field theory, calculate the freeze out abundance, using the same techniques that we did for dark matter. If your number is equal to 10 to the minus 9, or can be naturally made equal to 10 to the minus 9 by choosing the appropriate parameters in the theory, and you say, this may be, you know, I may be in business, I may have a theory that is a that is a candidate for beyond the standard model physics that produces the antimatter-matter asymmetry in the universe. Was that...
I thought that was a little bit of what you were hoping.
That was what?
It's been...
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, I apologize to be so hasty about that, but so this is just, I didn't want to give no flavor of what baryogenesis was about, but so the basic point is that using arguments analogous to the dark matter ones that we did, you can check for a variety of baryogenesis scenarios, yeah, whether they work. Just like dark matter is giving us some precious clue about physics beyond the standard model, probably. So similarly, baryogenesis is. And so, it pays to know how to check whether your suggested candidate is consistent. You know, does or does not solve the problem. Okay. Now, inflation. So, in this lecture, I just want to get across I just want to revisit in a form that is, in my opinion, clearer and more unified. What are the sort of classic puzzles that lead you to inflation, and just mention for a moment why, you know, inflation is not the only way you could imagine solving those problems. But viewed from this perspective, they all kind of seem to point to the same. They all seem to point to the same solution, which suggests that it may be a good one. And then in the next two lectures, so this lecture I'm just going to explain three puzzles and the right way to think about them, simplest way to think about them. So they're all those puzzles are going to lead us to the idea, okay, maybe we should have a period in the early universe where A double dot was greater than zero. But prior to the radiation-dominated era in which the universe began decelerating, prior to that, sometime in the very early universe, there was this period of inflation, by which we mean a period with A double dot greater than zero. So then, once those puzzles are presented, I just want to explain the fact that the simplest canonical, the most canonical model for what you can write down, for what is the simplest physical theory you can write down that will produce A double dot greater than zero? Well, the simplest thing you can do is write down a cosmological constant. But if you just wrote down a cosmological constant, that would never go anywhere. You need it to eventually decay into radiation, which a cosmological constant will not do. The universe will just go on accelerating forever if you put in a cosmological constant. And that's not the universe we see today. So the simplest thing that does what you want, namely it has a period with A double dot greater than zero and then transitions to a period with A double dot less than zero when it can dump its energy into radiation, is a scalar field. Is you just have gravity plus a single scalar field with potential V of phi. And so then I want to just explain that for the simplest potential you can think of, just a free massive scalar field, that this potential successfully resolves these puzzles, but in addition, most impressively, it predicts a very particular spectrum of tiny fluctuations in the density in the early universe that continue to be in beautiful agreement with very precise observations of the cosmic microwave background and other cosmic structure. Okay, so and this was sort of historically how things went. People first realized that a period of inflation could solve these puzzles, and then a year or two later they realized that much more convincingly that it could produce a matching spectrum of perturbations that matched observations. Okay, so let's first discuss the puzzles. So the main picture that I want you to keep in mind, so the three puzzles are easier to understand if you start from a point which might not be the intuitive one, which is that you let's lay down co-moving observers, okay? And then let's work in let's imagine the board is covered by co-moving coordinates. So this is two spatial coordinates. So as the universe evolves, that means since we're working in co-moving coordinates, the observers just sit there. You know, even though physically the distance between them is getting larger as the universe expands. On the board here, we're not plotting the physical distance between them, we're plotting the co-moving distance between them. So if you want, in the case that's easiest to visualize, where the universe is a closed universe, k equals plus 1, so it's a sphere, and the expansion of the universe is just saying that balloon is inflating. The co-moving observers are, you've just made some marks on the sphere with the marker, and they just sit at the same point on the balloon, although as the balloon expands, the marks get further and further apart from their neighbors. So the next thing to say is that at any given moment in the evolution of the universe, so at time t, there is the expansion rate h of t. So a dot of t over a of t. So this has units of 1 over time, right? Because it's just it's a over a, so whatever units they had cancel, and then there's a d dt. So this has units of 1 over time. So 1 over h has units of time, or because we've set c is equal to 1, so c is equal to velocity, which is length over time. So 1 over h has units of length. So at any given moment, the Hubble radius is some physical length scale characterizing the universe at that moment. Okay, so this observer at some time t, the observer measures the expansion rate of the universe and draws a little sphere around himself of that size. That's not, so the sphere is on the circle. I don't know how to draw that really. Okay, how about this observer? This observer draws a little sphere around himself. That is the physical size. But then I can convert between physical size. Remember, if two observers are separated by co-moving coordinate, so remember the metric looks like ds squared is equal to minus dt squared plus a squared times d chi squared. Okay, so if two observers are separated by co-moving coordinate chi, by some co-moving distance delta chi, then their physical distance is a times delta chi. Right? The physical spatial distance obtained by integrating in the chi direction. This expression is a times the d chi, if we're just integrating in the pure, for simplicity, in the purely radial spatial direction. Okay, so this is somehow the physical size between co-moving observers. So, in other words, if two co-moving observers have constant delta chi between them, they're both sitting at constant co-moving coordinates, and as the universe expands, as a expands, their distance is getting further and further apart. Their physical distance is getting further and further apart. So we can also go in the other direction. We can go from a physical distance to a co-moving distance this way. So in particular, if we want to plot, in particular, this characteristic length scale at any given time, we can divide by A to find the characteristic co-moving length scale, the characteristic co-moving Hubble radius at that moment. Okay, so 1 over h is called the Hubble radius. It's just this characteristic scale that is the sort of key scale behind a lot of the physics going on in any given moment. 1 over A is the co-moving version of that, the co-moving distance that corresponds to. Okay, so so in co-moving coordinates, the observers just sit there, but in a decelerating universe, the co-moving radius increases. So if at some early time this co-moving observer sees this co-moving radius, it includes not very many other co-moving observers, as the universe gets older and older, as the decelerating universe gets older and older, the co-moving Hubble radius gets bigger and bigger. So his sort of characteristic sphere that he draws around himself includes more and more other co-moving observers as a decelerating universe gets older. Okay? With an accelerating universe, the opposite is true. Initially, let's say at some early time, he may have a co-moving Hubble radius that includes a lot of other observers, but then as the universe accelerates, it shrinks, and so observers who used to be within his co-moving radius are now outside of it, and he sees fewer and fewer co-moving observers around him. Okay, so thinking in terms of co-moving, in terms of co-moving Hubble radius and co-moving coordinates, a priori this notion of co-moving Hubble radius may not be the most intuitive thing to you, but it just makes the meaning of these three puzzles simpler, as follows. Okay, so puzzle one, the first two puzzles we've met before, but I just want to explain them in a slightly different way. So the flatness puzzle can be understood as follows. Remember, our two key equations that we derived, we took the Einstein equations and then we specialized to the case of a FRW universe, and we found that these complicated Einstein equations boil down to just two equations, the Friedmann equation and the continuity equation. So now I just want to, for the purposes of this discussion, rewrite those two equations as two equivalent equations. So first, the first equation we obtained by just dividing by h squared in the Friedmann equation. So that becomes 1 equals rho over the critical density minus the constant k over ah squared. Okay, where remember the critical density I'm just defining to be 3h squared over 8 pi g. It's the density such that if I plug in the critical density here, then this term equals this, and so this term is negligible. And so that's the flatness puzzle. What you see from this equation is that. So this is just a constant over here. So the question is, how do these two guys, what are their relative contributions to unity? What are their two fractional contributions? And so here, written this way, you can just clearly see that as AH increases, if AH is increasing, then the fractional contribution of this term, the curvature term, goes down. So AH goes up means that the curvature term becomes negligible. And so rho over rho crit, rho approaches rho crit. In other words, so when this becomes negligible, rho approaches rho crit. But AH, that's A times A dot over A, so that's A dot. So A dot going up, that's just the same as A double dot is greater than 0. So when A double dot is greater than 0, this equation says that rho is driven towards the critical density, and this term becomes negligible in the Friedmann equation. And conversely, you know, by exactly the same logic, when A double dot is less than 0, rho is driven away from the critical density. This term gets, so in other words, when A double dot is less than 0, the universe is decelerating. That means AH is decreasing. This term is getting bigger and bigger until it overwhelms this term and becomes the dominant term on the side of the equation. So the flatness puzzle again is we're just at the end of an extremely long, you know, the old picture of the universe before inflation was that today the universe is 10 billion years old. It has just undergone a very long period of radiation domination, followed by a very long period of non-relativistic matter domination, both of which have this property that A double dot is less than zero. So according to this argument, they both have this property that they've been making this term dominate more and more, the right-hand side of this equation. So why is it that instead what we observe today is not that this term dominates the right-hand side of this equation, but that it's less than 1% of the contribution to the right-hand side of this equation? It's so small that we haven't observed it yet. We haven't observed any evidence of it yet. And so this, the solution proposed by inflation is that is just to tack on. I mean, there's various possible ways you could solve this, right? You could just say there's some other bit of physics that demands that k is equal to zero, that demands that only spatially flat slices of the universe are possible, that something prevents the universe from being, I don't know, topologically curved into a sphere. So that could be the answer. We don't know any such law of physics, but so inflation's answer is just that, let me rephrase the flatness puzzle to say inflation's answer a little bit more intuitively. Let me rephrase the flatness puzzle that so today this thing is less than 1% of the right hand side. So as you look back earlier, back through the matter and then radiation dominated eras, this term was just becoming more and more negligible. So if you look, for example, back to the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, that the fact that this is less than 1% today means that at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis that it was less than 10 to the minus 31 times the size of this term. So the rho was incredibly close to the critical density at that earlier time. So the question phrased in this way is, given how close the rho is to the critical density today, it was absurdly close to the critical density at the beginning of the radiation-dominated era. You know, what made, why was rho so closely equal to rho critical at the beginning of the radiation-dominated era? And the answer of inflation is that before the radiation-dominated era, at some time in the far past, maybe rho was not equal to rho critical. But then there was a long period with A double dot greater than zero, which, according to this argument, drove inflation. A long period of inflation, A double dot greater than zero, which drove rho toward rho critical. It drove it so far toward rho critical that by the beginning of radiation domination, that even though it's been drifting away from rho critical ever since between the beginning of radiation domination and today, it hasn't drifted away enough to be observable yet. Okay, so how much inflation is needed? Well, so what we see here is that the key quantity in this whole argument is AH. So let's define the number of e-folds of inflation to be so during inflation, AH is increasing. That's the idea. So let's define the total number of e-folds to be the log of the total increase, the total factor by which it increases. So AH at the end of inflation, in other words, AH at the start of the radiation-dominated era, divided by AH initial, AH at the beginning of inflation. So N is, you'll hear people call N the number of e-folds of inflation. So how big would N have to be to solve this flatness problem? Well, one way to say it is suppose that initially this term, that initially at the start of inflation, there was no particular flatness problem. Neither of these terms was tiny or huge relative to the other. They were approximately equal. By the end of inflation, the contribution of this term had been suppressed by a factor of e to the minus 2n, right? By a factor of e to the minus 2n just means ah final squared over ah initial squared. The opposite, I mean to say. And then subsequently, it has grown by the factor. Here's what I mean to say. Let me say this less opaquely. So today, we know that 0.01 is greater than this quantity. This quantity contributes less than 1% to the right-hand side. So the absolute value of k over ah today squared, we can rewrite that as the absolute value of k over ah at the beginning of inflation, which we take to be about equal to 1, times ah inflation over, at the beginning of inflation, sorry, I'll write and then say, okay, so I'm just multiplying and dividing by unity in the form of, I'm just taking this expression, multiplying and dividing by ah at the beginning of inflation squared. So I've just multiplied by 1, and I've multiplied by 1 again. So if there was no tuning at the beginning of inflation, then this quantity, the amount by which ah shrunk during inflation, so e to the minus 2n, times the amount by which ah grew between the end of inflation, the beginning of radiation domination, and the present day, has to be less than 0.01. And so if you turn it around, that turns out to say that n has to be bigger than, use the wrong notes, just don't want to write down the wrong formula. So n has to basically be bigger than, okay, let's neglect this 0.01. You could just, because these other factors are so enormous, these two factors, if we change this 0.01 to 1, it wouldn't change things. You can include it or not include it, but roughly speaking, this is just saying that n is greater than log of this number, and if you use the fact that A is proportional to rho to the minus 3, 1 plus W, that we derived earlier, and the fact that H, for a nearly flat universe, which our universe always was, so H squared is proportional to rho from the Friedmann equation, you can convert this into the log of the ratio of rho to some power at the beginning of radiation domination over rho to that power today. And the result is something like 30 plus log rho to the 1/4 over a GeV. So rho to the 1/4, remember rho is energy per volume, so that has units of energy to the fourth. So rho to the 1/4 is just a mass scale. It's another way to say it is that in a radiation-dominated epoch, rho is equal to a factor g times pi squared over 30 t to the fourth. So rho to the 1/4 is basically t. So the energy scale at the start of radiation, or the temperature at the start of radiation, is the thing that appears in the numerator here. So what was the temperature at the start of the radiation-dominated era? Well, at the very least, the radiation-dominated era should have started before Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So that would correspond to an energy scale of 1 MeV. So if you plug that in, that would correspond to saying that so if you plug in the BBN value, as a lower bound on the start of radiation domination, that means that the number of E-folds of inflation has to be greater than something like 25. On the other hand, the most that the radiation domination, the highest temperature that you could conceivably have at the beginning of the radiation dominated era and have this classical general relativity analysis be remotely reasonable would be to put in the Planck density, 10 to the 19 GeV, in which case you get something more like n is greater than 70. And then if you instead plug in what a value which, as we will see, is a kind of reasonable one, which is the gut scale. This is, if there's, we don't know what energy scale inflation actually happened at and what energy scale the radiation-dominated era started at. That's a number that is hugely unknown by many orders of magnitude at the moment. Turns out a lot of the predictions of inflation are insensitive to that, so you can still make a lot of progress. So we don't know. But if there's one favored scale where you might say it's expected to live at, it would be the gut scale. And so anyway, that would correspond to something like 65. And so you hear people say, this is kind of the number to keep in mind. This number is probably absurd. It's hard to imagine that you could have an inflationary era that was somehow managing to hide at the 1 MeV scale and end right before Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and yet not mess up anything else about cosmology, but also not have been detected in any other way in collider experiments or something. So in any case, n has to be, the universe has to expand by a huge factor is what this is saying. So AH, the co-moving horizon, the statement is that to solve the flatness problem, the co-moving horizon shrinks, not just by a little bit, but by e to the 25 or 60 or 70. It shrinks by some huge factor, okay? And so the volume, at the beginning of inflation, some observers' co-moving horizon scale was something large, and then at the end of inflation, the co-moving horizon scale had shrunk to some tiny little thing surrounding that co-moving observer. Okay, so if you say that in terms of the sphere, it gives another interpretation of what the flatness puzzle is. So the flatness puzzle is, another way to say what the flatness puzzle is why at the moment is the co-moving Hubble radius that I draw around myself so small relative to the radius of curvature of the sphere that I'm living on, which is A. Sorry. So why is the physical Hubble radius, h to the minus 1, that I draw around myself so small relative to the physical radius of curvature of the sphere that I might be living on? So why is that tiny relative to A? Or in other words, why is 1 over AH much less than unity? So it's another way to say it. Instead of saying that this term is small relative to this one on the right side of the Friedman equation, it's this other statement that there are two length scales characterizing my universe. One is the instantaneous Hubble scale, h to the minus 1, and the other is the instantaneous curvature radius. And why is it that even though this guy has been growing throughout the matter and radiation-dominated epochs relative to this guy is still so tiny relative to this guy, it's so tiny that, that I can't even, I'm looking at such a, I'm in contact with such a small patch of the sphere that I can't even tell that it's a sphere. It looks, for all I can tell, like just a piece of a plane. Okay. So the flatness puzzle, I mean the horizon puzzle, is now closely related, because in a universe that is matter or radiation dominated, if the universe was matter or radiation dominated all the way back, then the co-moving, what I was calling the co-moving Hubble radius, 1 over ah, that is up to an order one factor that depends on whether I am in matter domination or radiation domination. That is equal to the maximum co-moving distance, chi, from which I could have received a light signal. So when I look out at the so again, we had mentioned the horizon puzzle before, but when I look out at the CMB, so I look out along my path light cone. In a radiation dominated era, so this is the co-moving coordinate chi in this direction and the co-moving coordinate eta in this direction, time and co-moving radius. In those coordinates, as we had explained in a previous lecture, my light cone looks just like a light cone in Minkowski space, except that in a decelerating universe, it only goes back for a finite value, a finite amount of eta. If I go back a finite distance in eta, I reach the Big Bang. I can't extend my light cone any further. So there's some finite chi out to which I can see. I have a past horizon, and since the Big Bang, no observer outside that past horizon is able to send me a signal. So now, the CMB radiation comes from very early in the history of the universe. It comes from some circle along my past light cone, some sphere along my past light cone, which is not very far from this ultimate sphere that goes all the way back to the Big Bang. It comes from some very distant sphere. And a given point on a given point in space that emitted CMB radiation to me along my co-moving light cone, his past light cone also only extends back to the Big Bang. And so two distant points on my CMB have past light cones that were nowhere near each other. So this point could never have received any information from over here since the Big Bang in a radiation-dominated universe, and vice versa. So the horizon puzzle is, why is it that when I look along my past light cone at the light that was photons that were just traveling along to me along geodesics this way and along geodesics this way, why is it that the spectrum of those photons is the same in both directions? That anywhere that I look on my past light cone, I see a thermal spectrum of radiation with exactly the same temperature. Okay? And so the point is that here you can phrase the puzzle in exactly the same way. Again, the key quantity that appears is this quantity ah. And just as in the flatness puzzle, the problem boiled down to the fact that in a universe without inflation, ah is always decreasing as you go forward in time. You can fix it by having an early period where ah is increasing. Similarly, so the exact same thing is true here, and the way you can see that is that So remember, we had the way we previously discussed horizons was we wrote our metric this way, and then we switched to conformal time. So our metric looked like this. And we said, now consider a photon that has just arrived to us moving in the radial direction. It moves along ds squared is equal to 0. So that means, by this equation, d eta squared is equal to d chi squared. And taking the square root, d eta equals minus d chi. So that as time goes on, the photon is moving to smaller and smaller radius. So it gets to me. It's arriving towards me. So integrating this equation, the maximum chi that a particle can come from, can have come from since the Big Bang, the co-moving coordinate corresponding to my past horizon, the maximum co-moving radius from which I could have received a signal since the Big Bang, is nothing but eta today minus eta at the Big Bang. And that's nothing but t Big Bang to t today dt over a, right? Because to change coordinates here, I plugged in dt is a eta, so eta is dt over a, okay? But I can rewrite the integrand here as dt over dA times 1 over A dA. So I've just multiplied and divided by dA. So in other words, this is 1 over dA over A times 1 over A dot. But 1 over A dot is 1 over AH. Okay, integrated from A equals 0 to A of today. And so when written in this way, what you see is that the whole question of whether I have a finite, so the problem, the whole horizon problem with the CMB is that in a radiation-dominated universe, this integral converges when I integrate it all the way back to A equals 0. So now I want, so written in this way, you can see that the difference between whether this integral will converge or not converge at A equals 0 is just whether this factor is decreasing or increasing as a function of time in the vicinity of A equals 0, right? So I mean, I'm just saying that if you do an integral xn dx from 0 up to a finite value of x, then okay, so then this integral is 1 over n plus 1 x to the n plus 1 evaluated at 0 and x. And if n is less than 1, the answer, if n is less than 1, then when I plug in x equals 0 here, I get infinity. Whereas if n is greater than minus 1, I get a finite value for the integral. And so so in the absence of this factor, I'm exactly at the threshold case. I'm at the n equals minus 1 threshold value right between the integral diverging at A equals 0 and converging. And so this is the factor that tips the balance. If this factor is decreasing with time, you know what I mean? In a decelerating universe, this tips the balance. It tips this from going as A to the minus 1 to A to the minus less than 1. A to the less than minus 1. Whereas if it is increasing as you go forward in time, then it tips it the other way. It tips it to A going as a power which is greater than minus 1. Sorry, I wrote minus in both cases. You know what I mean. There is nothing I could possibly say at this moment that would make you understand this better than you could just understand it by thinking about it yourself. If AH increases with time, the integral diverges. If it decreases with time, the integral diverges. One of those corresponds to an ordinary radiation-dominated or decelerating universe. The other one corresponds to acceleration. And if you ask, you know, how much acceleration or deceleration, this is just the last thing I'll say, you know, phrased in these terms, the main point is that we did this estimate of how many e-folds of inflation you needed to solve the flatness problem, and the answer was that the number of e-folds you needed was the log of AH evaluated at the beginning of radiation to AH evaluated today. You needed at least that many e-folds of inflation to make the flatness of the universe today natural. The exact same formula, we can now see, will be the difference between solving or not solving. This is exactly the same number of e-folds of inflation that is needed to solve the horizon problem, which you know you can see from the following from one of these pictures. So, I'm going to draw a new picture. So again, here are my, I have a lot of co-moving observers. One of them is particularly special to me. This one is you. This one is or me. We're at pretty much the same place. Anyway, you guys mean a lot more to me than almost any of these other co-moving observers. That's for sure. So the horizon problem stated in this sort of picture is that at the time of the Big Bang, everyone was surrounded by, again, in a normal radiation-dominated universe, your co-moving Hubble horizon is also approximately equal to the actual past horizon, chi. Your co-moving Hubble radius works out to be almost exactly the same as the maximum co-moving distance from which you can have received a signal. And so here we are today. Here is the co-moving observer that we are today, but at an earlier time, at the time of the CMB. And we had a tiny little horizon surrounding us, at least from this, if we imagine that we were living in a radiation-dominated era. We had a tiny little co-moving Hubble sphere surrounding us. And then here is a point that emitted CMB radiation to us, and it had a tiny little sphere around it. And this one had a tiny little sphere around it, too. And then as the universe went along, our co-moving horizon increased. We saw CMB radiation from further and further away until today. Our co-moving horizon is this big thing. We're just seeing CMB radiation from this point and this point, which in a radiation-dominated epoch, we're never in contact with one another. Because in a purely decelerating universe, this co-moving volume has always been expanding. But the idea of inflation is going to be that actually, in the past, let's say that the universe prior, even before inflation began, was radiation-dominated, matter-dominated, some not accelerating universe, and the co-moving Hubble radius at that time was even bigger than our current CMB, than the sphere corresponding to the current CMB. Then there would be no problem. If the original volume was a lot bigger than the volume containing the current CMB, that means that they did have plenty of time to communicate with one another. And it just looks today like they haven't had a chance to communicate with one another because inflation took this sphere and shrunk it down to some incredibly tiny thing. And then since the end of inflation, this thing has been growing back out again. This co-moving Hubble radius has been growing back out again, and it's just gotten out to this sphere that we call the current CMB, which but it hasn't yet gotten out to the size that it was before inflation. So I mean the basic point is that this sphere is our current co-moving Hubble radius, but that's only our actual horizon under the assumption that we were that only represents what we have been in causal contact with under the assumption that it was radiation domination all the way back. If you relax that assumption and allow a period of inflation, we see that this sphere can go in and out in wacky ways. And in particular, the condition is that the size of the sphere, the amount that the sphere was shrunk during inflation, has to be greater than the amount that it has re-expanded since the end of inflation. That's exactly what this condition says. Okay? That, remember, n is the log of the factor by which precisely the log of the factor by which the radius of the sphere shrunk, and that has to be greater by this argument than the log of the factor by which it has re-expanded since the end of inflation. That becomes this just very geometrical requirement that if you want the most distant points that we can see today to have been in causal contact in the past, the original Hubble, co-moving Hubble sphere had to contain them. So there's no lecture tomorrow. I was just going to briefly say, historically, there's this third puzzle, the monopole problem, which I'll just briefly qualitatively say what it is, and again, why the same picture explains why the monopole problem is solved. I think it's maybe a less important motivation for inflation now than it was historically. So the final two lectures will be on Friday, and they will be an explanation of this second point, this what has turned out to be, you know, the most important thing about inflation, which is that it is like the it's you know, even better than Hawking's calculation of black hole thermodynamics, because it calculates a particular spectrum of quantum fluctuations produced by gravity that is actually observable and for the simplest models is in perfect agreement with present day observations. So, yeah. Okay. See you.